Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Another family values proselytizer is exposed as a hypocrite. I mean, family values doesn't usually mean having more than one.
That's a great line, isn't it? From political analyst Doug Muzio on Vito Fisella from our show the other day. Family values doesn't usually mean having more than one. And here's how our New York City congressman with two families has defended family values. According to the Daily News, as I mentioned before the top of the hour, he shuns his gay sister. The news quotes a source close to the family saying he won't even attend family events that include his sister, Victoria, and her partner and their two children. So that's at the personal level. On the policy level, in Congress, he has voted for all kinds of ways to make life harder, specifically for gay families, never mind individuals, for gay couples and gay parents. According to the news, he voted to prohibit any funding for joint adoptions by gay couples. He voted for a federal ban on gay marriage. He even demanded the withdrawal of federal housing funds from San Francisco unless it repealed its local domestic partnership law. Which brings us to our next guest. Yale Law Professor William Eskridge, author of a new book called Dishonorable Passions, Sodomy Laws in America, 1861 to 2003. So I guess we'll span Lincoln to Fisella now as we welcome Professor Eskridge back to WNYC. I bet that's not how you expected to be introduced.
Brian, it's always a treat to be here.
Why start with 1861? Did the Civil War have an impact on what we now call gay rights?
Brian, the reason we start with 1861 is that was the publication of the second edition of Leaves of Grass, Walt Whitman's great collection of poetry, much of which was homoerotic in the famous Calamus poems that were included in Leaves of Grass. So we start with Walt Whitman, and we end with John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner in 2003.
Did Lincoln ever mention gay rights? I see there are two passing references to Lincoln in the book, but not really policy-oriented.
Lincoln had no interest in gay rights, and even the entire idea of being homosexual or gay was not something that in the 1860s they would have understood.
And it's interesting that you frame the bookends of time in this book of about law by a law professor with two artists.
Well, it's a book about cultural and social attitudes, and part of the argument of the book, Brian, is that the evolution of America's sodomy laws, both making sodomy a crime and expanding the nature of the crime, and then later overriding it, at least for consensual activities, that has been driven not so much by legal developments, but it's been driven by social movements, the changes in cultural mores, and the like. And for that, it seems to me artists are much more important than law professors.
And the law reflects the culture. It was ever thus.
The law, to some extent, molds the culture, but very much reflects the culture and is sometimes driven by it.
Now, your book title is Sodomy Laws in America, not Anti-Homosexuality Laws. Why did you use that word, sodomy?
Well, because it's a book about the history of sexuality in America in many ways. And sodomy was never well defined in the 19th century. It was specifically defined in the 20th century to include oral sex as well as anal sex. And traditionally, it always included relations between men and women, between men and men, not between women and women until well into the 20th century. So this is really a book about changing laws and morality about sexual relations generally, and the rise and ultimately recognition of non-procreative sexual pleasure as a focus of Americans' family and other intimate lives.
So why were women left out? Why was, in effect, lesbianism left out?
It was all about the male penis, traditionally in American sexual regulation. We're talking about seduction laws, we're talking about rape laws, and we're also talking about sodomy laws. That literally in American law, for most of our history, and in some states, was never regulated female sexuality. There always had to be a man involved. There always had to be penetration by a male or an animal penis into someone else's orifice.
Were women just considered so insignificant, so beside the point to anything once upon a time in American jurisprudence that it didn't matter, you know, even to their sense of what we now call traditional family values if women slept together?
Well, it's about two things. It's about sexuality and it's about gender role. That sexuality in America has always been fraught with great ambivalence because Americans are prurient and obsessed with sex, and they're also puritanical and appalled by sex, right? And then sexuality has also been driven by gender role. And in the gender role story, the man has been the predator. The man is the aggressor, but it also means that the man is dangerous, and he's someone who needs to be controlled. So whether it's man against animal, man against child, man against woman, or even man against other man, the male sexual aggression has been the object of enormous and sometimes hysterical social anxiety and legal regulation.
Yeah, law professor William Eskridge, my guest. His new book, Dishonorable Passions, Sodomy Laws in America, 1861 to 2003. We can take your phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. You cite the period from about 1880 to 1920, which I think of roughly as the Ellis Island era, as a time that sodomy laws extended to a host of heterosexual practices. What happened at that time?
Well, by the 1920s, America is refocusing a lot of its energy onto homosexuality. That as American families become more and more comfortable with the ideas of contraception, with oral sex within the family, heterosexual oral sex, the emerging and more visible gay and lesbian communities in cities like New York become universal scapegoats. So, and this is interesting in relation to your Fosella story, and that is that people's own sexual relations about which they have enormous anxiety become displaced onto a marginalized subgroup, people of color, immigrants, and people who were called homosexuals and, quote, other sex perverts.
So did I get that backwards? I said the heterosexualization of sodomy laws. Was it really the homosexualization?
Yes, sir. It was definitely the display. Even though the laws remained applicable to everybody in every jurisdiction in the 20s and the 30s, the social meaning of sodomy shifted between, say, 1918 and 1946 from the married couple, the dating couple, to the gay male couple.
And the word homosexual comes from that era, doesn't it?
The word didn't even exist in the English language until 1891. And it didn't become popular in America until the World War I and post-World War I era.
I mean, it sounds like, you know, without knowing all the current politics behind that word as opposed to other words to refer to the same thing, it sounds like kind of a scientific clinical term.
And it was. It was in terms of focusing on certain people who were homosexuals. This idea was originally a medical idea in Germany, Europe, and later the United States in the late 19th century. Sigmund Freud and the American Freudians popularized it here, and people picked up on it and ran with it as a way of managing the enormous anxieties they felt about immigration, about sexuality, about oral sex, about contraception, about a whole host of social maladies.
The other part of your title, Dishonorable Passions, comes from the New Testament, doesn't it?
Yes, sir. It comes from Romans 1, 26 through 27.
I couldn't have told you that.
It's the only part of the Bible that focuses not just on male-male relations, but apparently on female-female relations as well. And Romans 1, 26 through 27, which uses the term dishonorable passions, is the biblical basis by which many American traditionalist Christians are very condemnatory of lesbian and gay relations, including committed relationships.
Is that where they use the word abomination?
Abomination is in Leviticus, and it's used in Leviticus and other books of the Bible to refer not just to men lying with men, but in Deuteronomy, cross-dressing by women or men is also an abomination to the Lord. And I might add in Leviticus, wearing clothing made of more than one fabric is also an abomination to the Lord.
So the whole poly cotton thing.
Abomination to the Lord, Brian. And yeah, if you are a strict reader of the Bible, you not only should disapprove of male relations, but you also should disapprove of those cotton poly blends.
Cross-dressing was in the Bible?
In Deuteronomy, yes, sir. That if you are a woman who does not wear the attire of her sex, you're an abomination to the Lord. Rudy Giuliani, cross-dressing mayor of New York City, abomination to the Lord, according to the book of Deuteronomy.
But he did it in jest.
Abomination to the Lord, Brian.
I've seen all kinds of Christians and Jews wearing cotton poly blends. Have you noticed that?
Yes, sir, and it's an abomination to the Lord if you read the Bible literally.
You also use the historical term crime against nature. Where did that come from?
The crime against nature was the English term. It was referred to by Edward Cook and Blackstone as sort of an undifferentiated concept for non-procreative sexuality. You see, in the Anglo-English tradition, sexuality is guilty unless proven innocent. And traditionally in the United States, the innocence has been established by procreative marriage, where you have solemn religious vows and a child pops out after about 9 months. Otherwise, sex needs to be explained.
In fact, let's bring in Matthew in Manhattan on that point. Hi, Matthew, you're on the air. Matthew, you can turn your radio off because here we are. All right, you know what? We'll come back to Matthew in just a minute. Matthew, be patient. We'll get to you. But you remember this right? You said the period from the 1600s, the 16th century to the 20th century was the period where sexuality was generally defined by the culture as needing to have to do with procreation, with making children.
Procreation within marriage.
Within marriage, excuse me. But why start at the 16th century? Wasn't it always that or mostly that in human history?
It was always concerned with marriage within the Christian tradition, but there was not the legal focus until the period of the 16th century. The first sodomy law in the English tradition was the law of King Henry VIII. Remember, that's the one with six, not eight wives, half of whom he murdered, right? So the king who murdered half of his wives and, of course, was adulterous with the other half is also the ones who gave us the original crime against nature law, which was transposed into the colonies.
Henry VIII makes Vito Fisella look boring.
Henry VIII, definitely a squalid purveyor of traditional family values.
Matthew in Manhattan, I think we have you now, do we? Matthew? Is he still listening to his radio? All right, let's try Frank in the Bronx. Frank?
Hi.
Hi.
Good morning. This is like a major psychological pattern that mainly Republicans use to control people. We have an example, a clear example with Mark Foley. He cried on the floor in Congress, asking people to stop predators on the internet, like these child abusers, these depraved people. Guess what? He was having sex parties in Washington, D.C. with minors.
Right. Well, that's one of the worst examples that there probably ever was of that kind of hypocrisy or cover-up. No, you're shaking your head, Bill.
Well, Brian, I would say that Mark Foley is a particularly dramatic example of hypocrisy. Frank is exactly right about that. But Frank, I think, is onto something bigger, and that is that Americans in particular have the following feature towards sexuality. They're very ambivalent. And Americans practice a lot of sexual things, including sodomy, oral and anal sex, that they themselves consider disgusting. And it is quite possible to have both emotions. You're both aroused by it and attracted to it and enjoy it, and you're also repulsed by it. And so you see this in our public culture as well. Again, Americans are both obsessed with sex and they're both appalled by sex. And sometimes you see it in these dramatic things like the exposure of Mark Foley.
So anything having to do with, you know, adults with minors, no one would question the, you know, the horribleness of that, right? And there do need to be laws. We were joking about some of the laws before, but there certainly is such a thing as a sexual predator, and children need to be protected.
Part of the argument of the book, Brian, is that one of the great tragedies of sodomy laws has been that hysteria of enforcers like Mark Foley, people like him, toward enforcing sodomy laws against law-abiding, committed relationships between consenting adults. very often in American history, particularly in the 50s and onward, has displaced regulatory attention away from the real problems. The real problems in America are sexual harassment. The real problems are sexual predation against young people. The real problems are sexual assault. And that's always been the case. Throughout the 20th century, these have been genuine problems. And the periods in which we focused on consensual sodomy, particularly between committed couples, and a lot of the hysteria about same-sex marriage, have really cost this country a great deal by displacing a lot of our regulatory energy away from where it really should be focused, and that is against sexual predation.
William Eskridge, Yale Law Professor, my guest on WNYC. His new book, Dishonorable Passions, Sodomy Laws in America, 1861 to 2003. And a few people are calling in who didn't like us joking around about Polly and Cotton and leaving it there, and who want to clear up what the Bible really meant by not mixing different kinds of cloth, like Michelle in Westchester. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. The problem that I have is that what your guest is speaking about is very important, but to use shoddy scholarship, and I'm really surprised that a professor of law at Yale would do this, he must know that what the prohibition is poly and cotton and mixing linen and wool, which is called shotness, and it had something to do with mixing different types of natural elements. And to make fun of mixing things like poly and cotton, I question whether he's really looking at all of the arguments in the Bible in a way which is fair and balanced, or whether or not things are being spun in a way which makes things look comical and like a straw dog argument.
Brian, I think Michelle is raising a serious point, and here's the serious point that's underneath the jest, and that is that the word for abomination, toevah, is used throughout the Old Testament. It's used in Deuteronomy for cross-dressing. It's used in Leviticus for men lying with men. But it is also used in Leviticus for many, many other practices, including the mixing of fibers. And I think Michelle is right. The focus for the Israelites certainly would have been natural fibers. They would not have had a conception of polyester back in the biblical times. But the point I was making that Michelle, I think, has missed is that if you read the Bible literally, and that was the point I explicitly made, not only is men having relations with men an abomination, the translation of toevah, but also the mixing of fabrics. And that's the word that's used in the Revised
Standard Version. So your point is that while we may hear the word abomination as a big, big deal, the way it was used in the original Bible, the Old Testament, as Christians would call it, it was often to refer to relatively little things. So your point is, in what light should we see the prohibition against homosexuality today, correct?
Yes. The other thing is that in view of what we know about hormones and on genetics, I think that it's fair to wonder about who is a male and who is a woman, in the sense that there are people who may not be women and men in the biblical sense. And I don't think that the Bible would make light of that either.
I'm not sure I understood the question, but did you, Bill?
Let me try to combine both features of Michelle's question, because here's a deep theme of the book. A deep theme of the book is that many of the biblical prohibitions really go to mixing things that ought not to be mixed. And this is, I think, a deep undergirding of America's regulation of sexuality and indeed gender role, that Americans don't like, and indeed some of them are alarmed by, the mixing of male and female characteristics in the same person. These are things that should not be mixed. Literally an abomination. And the regulation of sexuality in America has often been driven by underlying themes of disgust and pollution. Again, pollution, the same kind of concept we see in toevah, things that are an abomination to the Lord. Now, one of the points of the book, however, is is that what we consider to be things that ought not to be mixed, i.e. A penis and a mouth, that's oral sex or fellatio, is a social construction and is often arbitrary and is often unlinked with some of the deeper moral lessons of the Bible. But if you read it literally, as many Protestants and Catholics have done, you can come up with broader readings than you should.
We have just a few minutes left. Let's go through a couple of bullet points of the history. You mentioned that in colonial times, homosexual acts or sodomy, certain kinds of sodomy, were capital offenses. Was anybody ever executed?
Yes, there were a number. I think there were as many as 21 colonists who were executed
for what in particular?
It was in almost every case, and maybe every case, for some kind of assaultive sexuality, assaulting either a minor or assaulting a man.
So it was real predation. It wasn't consensual sex. That was just considered outside cultural norms.
Exactly. In a few cases, and we don't know what happened to some of these people, people were sentenced but maybe not executed for interracial sexuality. So some of the examples I have in the book were a black man and a white man having sex together.
And you call the half generation after World War II, specifically 1945 to 61, both the golden age and the dark age of sodomy laws in America. Now, that's that small period of time from which we draw what became known as traditional family values, 1945 to 61. That's the Leave It to Beaver, Ozzie and Harriet era. And you call it both the golden age and the dark age of sodomy laws in America. Why?
Well, the reason it's the golden age is that was a period in which sodomy laws expanded all over America, both at the federal level and the state level. It's an era in which political entrepreneurs, and the main example I use is Governor Earl Warren of California, liberal Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, but who engineered the most ambitious anti-sodomy program in American history. And he engineered the most aggressive enforcement against gay people engaging in consensual relationships with people of the same sex. Indeed, it was Governor Warren who founded Atascadero, which was a mental hospital for sexual psychopaths, which was known in gay circle as the Dachau for queers. Mm. And the reason was is that gay people were incarcerated there against their will for indefinite periods of time, and they were subject to medical and pharmacological experimentation and what we would consider today torture in some cases.
And most of your book, though it's not been most of our discussion, is the history of sodomy laws 1961 to the present, which is the modern gay rights debate, really, right? Was 1961 itself, for some reason, a watershed year?
The reason I start with 61 rather than 69, which was Stonewall, is that in 1961, Frank Kameny, the great D.C. gay activist, filed an appeal in the U.S. Supreme Court arguing that gay people should not be subjected to discrimination based upon their alleged violation of sodomy laws, which he had been arrested for and lost his government job for.
And this, to finish up, is, I guess, where Vito Fisella comes in, because today, ironically, most so-called family values conservatives seem to accept, in legal terms, the rough idea of the state leaving gays and lesbians alone as long as they don't form families. So if they're living the old bugaboo of, you know, promiscuous hookups and bars and basements, there's a presumed right of privacy, very different from a century or two ago. But if they dare do what Victoria Fisella, the congressman's sister, apparently did, settle down with a partner, get inseminated, and raise two kids together, Harriet and Harriet, that's where all the juice is in the legal debate.
One of the things the book does, Brian, is it traces the evolution of American cultural attitudes and the law away from the idea that sexual variation is inherently malignant. So where the Fisellas are, and this is progress of a genuine sort, is they've moved away from the idea that it's malignant to the idea that sexual variety is tolerable. It's not as good as heterosexuality, but homosexuality is tolerable like some kind of disease. The gay marriage debate, which is, of course, the next big debate, is whether or not homosexuality and lesbian and gay relations are really ultimately a benign variation, and that lesbian and gay families, including with children, can serve basically the same kind of values that heterosexual families have traditionally served in our society.
And that open question remains an open question as we thank William Eskridge, author of Dishonorable Passions, Sodomy Laws in America, 1861 to 2003. It's published by Viking. And I see that you will be doing a Q&A and book signing and a talk at the New York Gay Community Center, 208 West 13th Street at 7 o'clock tonight. Right?
Tomorrow night.
Don't go Wednesday tonight. You won't see him there. Tomorrow night, Wednesday night, 7 o'clock, New York Gay Community Center, 208 West 13th Street for William Escrigier, law professor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian, as always.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, City Councilman John Liu will be here to tell you how you can help earthquake victims in China. Stay with us.